thanks for coming, everyone, and welcome to the Crips End of Tale Critical Thinkers Workshop. I think we've been for an action-packed and intellectually stimulating afternoon, followed by a visit to the pub at 5 o'clock. So, end of term is here, hurrah. Okay, so yeah, in an hour or so, we're going to get round to the two panels. It's basically just going to involve PhD students introducing a thinker that they're using in their own work. And there's no specific kind of guidance, but suggested things to be aware to contextualise the thinker, to sketch out their conceptual vocabulary, to illustrate their theoretical approach or orientation, and to outline their key works. So that's coming soon, but before that, Matt Watson, who I'm sure everyone knows, has kindly agreed to come along to give a talk on operationalising thinkers in your academic work, which is, I'm sure, something that we all kind of think about how to do it, and Matt's kindly agreed to kind of give a talk on this subject. So with no further ado, over to Matt.
Well, thanks very much, Andy, and good to be here, as always. Now, when Andy first floated this idea to me, he said, just matter-of-factly, can you say a few words on how and why to study thinkers within your PhD? And equally matter-of-factly, I said, yes, of course I can, without thinking what that would entail. As usual, when I commit myself to talking to Crips, I think it's going to be nice and straightforward. Then I sit down and think on the morning that I'm meant to be giving my paper what it is I'm going to say, and it all becomes a little bit more difficult in my mind. But I've got one or two strategies for trying to talk about the why and how to study thinkers. I also want to start with a couple of reflections on who counts as a thinker in the first place. I think it's extremely interesting that you've got a session to finish Crips off for the term on thinkers. But what makes someone count as a thinker as opposed to something else? What's the difference between a thinker and someone who is merely a scholar? Presumably there is a difference between the two. And what's the difference between a thinker, a scholar, and someone who just so happened to have a good idea once and wrote it down? These would seem to capture different categories of intellectual work. So there is an important question as to what sustains the reputation that some people have for being thinkers as opposed to other sorts of academics. I always say to my MA students that when I struggle to think of an example, I just talk about myself and my life, and we see how far we get there. So am I a thinker, for instance? My presentation notes now say, pause for a moment to take in all of the appreciative affirmative nods, but you're clearly not playing that game with me, so thank you very much. So am I a thinker? What makes the work that I do not classify in so many ways as a thinker of the same sort of stature of the people that we'll be discussing this afternoon? So the very notion of being a thinker implies something, I think anyway, qualitatively distinct from simply the routine day-to-day aspects of normal academic life. The notion of being a thinker as opposed to an alternative designation implies membership of an exclusive group. There are boundaries within academic life, and some people seem to transcend the normal boundaries of academic life. And presumably it's those people who, for whatever reason, have the designation thinker attributed to them. Possibly the way to identify a thinker comes with being able to sidestep the question, so why have you begun with that particular person? That it becomes so self-evident from their reputation that that is just an acceptable place to begin your PhD research. I think in terms of two of my PhD students from the past who have worked on Karl Polanyi, and the question that infuriated them time after time after time after time was when people said, oh, that's all very well and good, and you're clearly pushing back the boundaries of knowledge, and you're saying some extremely interesting things about the nature of the world, but why have you started with Polanyi? For a PhD on Polanyi, that would seem to be the right place to start, I would have thought. And it was an issue that confused them, puzzled them and annoyed them in equal measure, especially when an alternative thinker was being proposed as the starting point that they might have taken but didn't. So when my Polanyi PhD students were asked, why start with Polanyi, the subtext was always, why not start with Marx? So there are different categories of thinkerdom, even within the thinkers that we might routinely appeal to as being thinkers. So what puts you in this rarefied group rather than being placed in different company, for instance? Well, firstly, not an issue that I want to say too much about at the moment, but something that we might usefully discuss later on. Do you have to be male, looking at the programme in front of us today? I would hope very much that the answer is no. But then when we begin to think of all those people who have been designated as thinkers over history, then there would seem to be some sort of correlation that suggests that indeed it might help. So that would be unfortunate if thinker status is itself gendered within the academy. The question that I do want to ask, though, is do you have to be dead to qualify for the status of a thinker? I can satisfy myself now that you don't think that I'm a thinker because you can all see that I'm not yet dead. The answer here presumably is no, because at least a couple of the people that we're going to be talking about this afternoon are still alive. But again, it might help. It might help to be dead to have thinker status attached to you. And it might help in two distinct ways. So let me run through them, because I think there's an important point here in helping us to understand what makes a thinker rather than something else. Firstly, if you're dead, obviously there are lots of unfortunate things attached to being dead, but if you are dead, it does mean that you've left behind you a settled body of work. So the parameters of what you've written, the parameters of how you've expressed yourself are reasonably clear. At the very least, there's no reason to contemplate what you've written relative to what you still might write in the future. Your life's work is complete because your life, poor you, is over. So in Foucauldian terms, your personal archive of writings is there for others to study in its entirety, not just as a part of all those possible things that you might still write in the future. But your archive of personal writings is there to study in its entirety. And that might help a person to attract the designation of a thinker rather than one of the other scholarly designations that I've been talking about. For sure, future generations of scholars are likely to push your published work to its interpretive limits, often in the search for potential ambiguities in the way that you've written your thoughts down over a series of time. But this is all they're able to do. You are not able to talk to them from beyond the grave. They might be able to impose different interpretive strategies upon you, but that's all that's available for your work at the point at which you're no longer in existence. So until the seance becomes an accepted social science methodology, it looks very much as though you've finished at the point at which you are no longer physically with us within the world. It's not possible for you to write anything new at this stage. And it might be that it helps you to achieve this designation of thinker only when you reach the point at which it's not possible for you to write anything new. Secondly, along similar lines, I think, it often takes a considerable amount of time for someone to develop the reputation of a thinker. And this would seem to arise for two reasons, I think. Firstly, a scholar's work might not be recognised for its an intellectual far-sightedness in his or her time. It might just be too innovative to be given the respect that it deserves. It might only come to light subsequently as being something of intrinsic importance when a future generation of scholars discovers it and finds that it talks directly to them in ways which were not apparent to their predecessors. So the process of discovery of older masters who talk to newer agendas is obviously only a process of rediscovery, but it might be in the moment of rediscovery that the designation of thinker gets attributed to a particular person's work. I have an example of someone that I'm sure most of you won't have heard of, but given the nature of the work that he's been doing on performativity, Chris might have done. Louis Bachelier. Chris. Ever come across Louis Bachelier?
No.
A French chemist who wrote a chemist who chose to write a PhD in the new field of economics in 1900. Failed his PhD because nobody had a clue what he was talking about because of the way that he was trying to bring the methods of chemistry into social science analysis. Bachelier was rediscovered by Paul Samuelson in the 1950s and is now attributed with having thought through 50 years in front of his time all the bases of modern finance theory. So this is a process of somebody who in his own day was not even treated as being good enough to be awarded a PhD, who now amongst the community of finance theorists is very definitely a thinker in his own right. The related issue here is that perhaps the true test of a thinker is someone who can be shown to have decisively altered the subsequent course of their discipline, someone who fundamentally changes the way in which a particular subject field develops. An example that's close to my heart because of the work that I do is the designation of Adam Smith as the father of economics, somebody who created a series of theories about the way in which the world might be viewed that systematically changed the way in which the economic dimension of everyday life was conceptualised. But the status of a thinker is usually a post hoc rationalisation, something that's unavailable as a characterisation to that person's contemporaries. Smith is generally known as the father of economics today. He was not known as the father of economics in his own time. No, none of his contemporaries were aware or could have been aware that it was possible to observe in his work what would later be turned into the subject field that we now know as economics. You cannot be the father of economics before other people have recognised that it's economics that you were doing. And that recognition only took place sometime after Smith's death. So decisive turning points in scholarly fields often only become apparent much, much later than the point at which a particular scholar enacted that decisive turning point. So in general, the identification of one of these moments where the subject field moves onto a qualitatively new plane is only visible from a subsequent point in time, not available at the point of time at which the intellectual move is actually first made. And this produces an important problem, I think, in the use of a thinker's work, in that the thinker is often made to talk to an intellectual agenda which is of a later generation's making and not that of the thinker themselves. If you can only really genuinely get thinker status attributed to you under post hoc rationalisation, that's usually under post hoc rationalisation of an intellectual agenda that's of a successor generation's concerns and not the concerns that you yourself were directly talking about. So it's possible that the use of a thinker is, as often as not, to try to put words in their mouth, to make them speak to an intellectual agenda that emerged only subsequently. So an intellectual agenda that emerged a long time after they'd finished writing, and therefore an agenda which they could not have been appealing to directly in their own work. The multiple appropriations of Keynes, I think, is an interesting example of that. From the early appropriations of Keynes by neoclassical economists, Joan Robinson's famous category of the bastard Keynesians, who tried to fold Keynes's radical theory back into neoclassical ways of knowing that mitigated much of the both intellectual and policy radicalness. At the same time now, we see people in IPE trying to represent Keynes as some sort of preemptive constructivist, completely changing the notion of what his own methodology was all about. Keynes very definitely talked about conventionalism as his underlying ontology of economic behaviour. This is not the same as what modern-day constructivists mean by their constructivism, however. And so the appeal to Keynes among so many constructivist IPE scholars as a prototype constructivist is another way of showing how a thinker's work can be appropriated for a subsequent intellectual agenda and not for the intellectual agenda that they themselves were pushing. There is a problem here, and a problem in the use of all thinkers, that they can be misused as much as they are moved, as much as they are used. Vivian Brown has come up with an important concept, I think, when she talks about canonical history writing within particular subject fields, that people get repositioned as an original thinker, where they move the originality from their scholarship and replace it with conceptions that are deemed to be true today. So concepts might be changed in terms of their internal meaning. The intended outcome of the intellectual process might itself be morphed, specifically to allow the modern-day agenda to take dominance over the agenda that the thinker was originally talking about. So a thinker's work can get strategically repackaged then. It can get stripped of both its intrinsic subtleties and its intended meaning in order to meet the pedagogical requirement of teaching the basics of a subject field from the perspective of which they are deemed to be true today. So if a thinker gets used in these pedagogical ways, but without any clear sense of what's actually in their original texts, but they're used as stripped-down teaching devices to instruct students today in the basics of a subject field, then the designation of thinker status to them in that way is perhaps something that they themselves would not be particularly happy about. It's a poison chalice to be treated as a thinker in that way, rather than as a thinker in the way in which we might think in more enlightened terms that that status applies. So it might help an author to be dead to have thinker status attributed to their work, because their contribution is more obvious at the point at which they're dead, and also the decisive turning points that they might have enacted in their subject field are more apparent once they are dead. But equally, a dead thinker is powerless to respond to canonisation by attempting to reclaim the integrity of their work. So it could be a double-edged sword then to have the status of thinker attributed to your work. And overall, what does it mean to be a thinker in this respect? Well, the whole status itself is subjective, and it's linked to reputation. It's linked to academic reputation, and as we all know, in academic terms, reputation is usually a self-referential category. Somebody raises to great status because other people say that they are deserving of being raised to great status. That might be the main way in which any individual attains the status of a thinker within the social sciences, because other people are willing to use them in that way. So it becomes a self-referential process linked to the inherent subjectivity of what sort of argument is important at any one moment of intellectual time and what sort of argument is unimportant. So you must be prepared, I think, to defend your choice of a particular thinker if you're rooting your work within that thinker's work, even if it's perfectly clear in your own mind why it is that you would want to start with the work of that thinker. That still must be justified, and that still must be argued for in your own research. Okay, so if they are a few of the opening observations to the why questions and the who questions of why use thinkers and who counts as a thinker, then what insights do they give for how you might proceed to do so? So now I'll spend a few minutes talking about the how questions. And on the train this morning, I came up with, I think, 7 possible options. Hold on, I've just given away my preparation techniques there, haven't I, with the phrase on the train this morning. What I really meant was, after careful scholarly reflection in the 4 weeks since Andy first asked me to give this talk, I have come up with 7 possible options of the way in which thinkers can be used in research, in PhD research in particular. And they fall into markedly different camps, and those camps, I think, some of them are intellectually reputable uses of thinkers, and some probably are not and might need to be stayed clear of. I'd want to group these into 3 clusters, and I'm not sure my labels are particularly good in some instances, so we might at some stage discuss more suitable labels. So the first cluster is a straightforward pair, and it fits very closely with what I've been saying previously about canonisation. So I think there's a straightforward pair between canonical uses of thinkers and, with all due deference to Chris, Skinnerian uses of thinkers. Now, both of these strategies use a thinker as a means of establishing a framework within which the subsequent research is to be understood. Both of them are about claiming a home for the research that the student is undertaking, but they do so in very different ways. The canonical student is interested in embedding their work within the parameters of the existing field. It's all about nodding deferentially to orthodoxy and announcing a willingness to reproduce that orthodoxy in their own work. So the thinker's work itself is of entirely secondary consideration to the canonical student. What the thinker says in their own terms, the internal dimensions of his or her writing, is not the reason that attracts the canonical student to that thinker in the first place. What attracts the canonical student to the thinker in the first place is that that thinker's work is usually assumed to speak to the existing orthodoxy in that subject field. So to align one's own work with that orthodoxy often involves engagement with a deeply canonised view of a particular thinker's work. So there's no direct engagement with the text itself of those thinkers. No direct engagement with the text is necessary, and indeed direct engagement with the text might begin to query the way in which canonical status is attributed to particular thinkers. So it might be a good thing if you're a canonical student to avoid direct engagement with a thinker's text. How you then claim that you're rooting your work within that thinker, that's another question altogether. For the Skinnerian student, by contrast, the text is of paramount importance. The text is everything. The Skinnerian student might well experience a repetitive strain injury on the grounds of just how often they find themselves typing Control 2. And if Control 2 is not how you get the inverted commas that go around direct quotes, that clever insight of mine has just fallen completely flat. But that's what Skinnerian students often do. They use the text as an authoritative archive for that thinker's viewpoints, and they will quote fairly extensively from that text to try to produce a, in their minds, genuine sense of what that thinker was talking about. Skinner's methodological rules involve lots of warnings about the need to read the text in preference to the strategic reading into the text other agendas that might not have been there in the mind of the person writing the original body of work. So the creativity which matters here is linked to finding new ways of recovering what the thinker said in their own words, and not for putting words into the mouth of that thinker. Because there are two different ways of using thinkers in that respect. The canonical student is happy to allow words to be put in the mouth of a thinker, whereas the Skinnerian student is interested only in the words that the thinker wrote for him or herself. So, there's two really distinct ways of using thinkers in that respect. The Skinnerian student tries only to posit the preeminence of authorial intention, whereas the canonical student is interested in the strategic appropriation of the image of a thinker in order to nod deferentially to orthodoxy in the subject field. The Skinnerian approach, consequently, is often used as a direct antidote or a direct refutation of the pre-existing canonical approach. And for me, Chris will be happy that I'm going to say this, the Skinnerian approach gets a big thumbs up and the canonical approach gets a big thumbs down. Notice I pause there just to make sure that I got it right. To have one of my own PhD students have a heart attack because I accidentally got it wrong would not have been a good way to finish the term. So I did get that right, didn't I, Chris? Phew. The second cluster, again a pair. I've called these, in my systematic thinking over a period of weeks, a hagiography approach versus an approach centred on ad hominem critique. It was a strange journey this morning, obviously, given some of the labels that I've been using. But I'm sure you all instinctively know what I mean by those two phrases, and let me try to explain them in a bit more detail. In both instances, the text is used extensively, but with very different objectives in mind. The student engaged in hagiography will laud absolutely everything to be found in the text. No real critical engagement with it. They show that they know the text very well, but everything about the text is given an overwhelmingly positive endorsement. So the whole of the thinker's work will be subjected to one superlative after another. So you go to a thesaurus, look up all the words that mean brilliant, tremendous, excellent, ace, and those sorts of things, and then you just load your analysis with all of these superlatives, lauding to the hilt a particular thinker's work. So this is all about becoming a fully paid-up member of that thinker's fan club. And this often happens when a particular thinker becomes trendy in social science, and often that's the case, they do at particular moments of time, you will find lots and lots of hagiographical writing in which there is no critical engagement with that thinker, but merely an attempt to signal that you belong in the in-club by saying that you start from that thinker's perspective. There's no intention of engaging in constructive criticism as a means of exploring the outer limits of how that thinker's work can be used to ground innovative research. I'm not sure, though, how well you can claim to know a thinker if there's no attempt to focus on where they might have gone wrong, as well as on where their insights are most effective. Critique, as long as it's carefully crafted and representative of the text read as a whole, is always necessary if you're going to engage with the work of a particular thinker. I don't think it's really saying anything of any great value to merely conclude that X has already had the final word on a subject. It seems to be self-defeating to render your own work so entirely derivative in that way. What about originality criteria? Isn't that what we're all meant to be in the business of academia for? To actually try to make an attempt to say something new? If you're engaged in hagiographical use of thinkers' work, that would seem to be denied you right from the start. So hagiography gets another big thumbs down from me. And the same is true of its mirror opposite, ad hominem critique. The main feature of ad hominem critique is a failure to adequately contextualise a thinker's work. The original text might well be used as the archive on which the research is conducted, but this does not mean that an authentic representation of the text is provided. The ad hominem critique is usually a point-scoring exercise more than anything else, trying to prove just how clever you are by ridiculing a thinker that other people have found to be important to their work. So you can see why this is the mirror image of the hagiography approach. And this is often seen when a literature divides into hostile camps, because when a literature divides into hostile camps, the dialogue between those two camps is often based on caricature of the other's position rather than an informed and an engaged dialogue. And some of the biggest names in social science have been guilty of this in the past. If you're familiar with the Palanzas-Miliband debate from the 1970s, and if you trace that debate through in time, it's interesting that each of them at the beginning were accusing the other of holding a clearly caricatured account of that person's perspective. And then over time, both of them seemed to gravitate towards the other one's caricature. So they started off much closer than they finished up, and they finished up much further away from each other than they began, merely because they started to act out the other one's caricature of their work while complaining that their work had been caricatured by the other one in response. So Palanzas and Miliband, I think, would both classify for thinker status, so even thinkers can misuse other thinkers' work when engaging in ad hominem critique of this sort. And in general, I'm not impressed by this sort of work, as it isn't designed to move debates forward in any effective manner. Now, my third cluster, and this is where I'll end, represents three distinct ways where I think it is possible to use thinkers to move the debate forwards. The first one, I had real trouble with this label. I couldn't get past one-upmanship. And this is meant to be a positive use as well, and I could only think of something that sounds like a completely derogatory word to give it as a label. This is more about mining the text, I think. Does it mean one-upmanship? I don't know. You'll be able to tell me if there's a better word for it than that. But this is to prove that you know more than somebody else about the thinker whose work provides you with a common basis. So it is mining the text there. mining the text for a more in-depth analysis of what that thinker can contribute to the way in which we view the world today. So this is about fine-grained expertise. It's about the ability to display knowledge which might border on the encyclopedic at times. So knowledge designed to promote the authority of your interpretive study over that of other people's. And this is a common approach when writing in a history of ideas perspective, which is one of the reasons that I apologise for the derogatory designation, especially if the centre of gravity of a particular subject field is founded on a widely shared misconception of a thinker's work. I actually find myself doing quite a bit of this sort of work in IPE and the relationship between IPE and settled ideas on the nature of Adam Smith. So obviously I don't really want to call it one-upmanship because that sounds as though I'm being rude about some of my own work. We also see this often in modern political theory. How many times have you heard a modern political theorist saying that, well, no work has really taken place over the last 30 or 40 years that's anything other than adding footnotes to rules? And that's the way in which so much of that part of the profession now organises its debates. And there is nothing wrong with it. This is still generating new knowledge while using texts in a representative and authoritative manner. Also, a lot of work on Marx is about earning your stripes in terms of how well you know the text. Not only how well you know the text, but being able to point to instances in which other supposed Marxists perhaps do not know the text that they're writing about as well as they're claiming they do. Nick will recognise this sort of argument because that speaks to his PhD. So this approach definitely has its place there. You might be slightly limited in terms of what you can do with it, but it does definitely have its place. And to whatever extent you engage in this style of work, I think that it's necessary to combine it with my next approach. And the next approach I've called the explanatory approach. And this is the most self-evident in so many ways. It seems to me that the most obvious way to use a thinker's work is to facilitate explanatory social science. In other words, to set up a puzzle which can be thought of afresh by establishing the explanatory framework on the basis of how the thinker explains social phenomena in general. And I think if you combine text mining approach, see, I've stopped calling it one-upmanship now, with the explanatory approach, then these are significantly good ways of using a thinker's work. Because this is all about teasing out the distinctiveness of a thinker's perspective. Asking what makes their insights compelling is also asking what makes their insights different to approaching the same subject matter from an alternative perspective. So this is really just stating the obvious, I think, because we all know that the world looks completely different through competing theoretical lenses. And to use a thinker in this explanatory way is to shed light on the theoretical lens with which they're most associated and to bring that theoretical lens into explanation to allow you to say interesting things about the nature of the world that you encounter. So the use of a thinker in this way, I think, can be a very, very good way of organising a literature review in a PhD. Because it provides the basis of being able to cut the literature down into the sorts of focal points that fit best with your PhD topic. And the final option I want to briefly discuss is what I would call the interdisciplinary approach to the use of a particular thinker. Another approach that gets the thumbs up from me. And possibly this is only a subset of the explanatory approach, because the end goals of the two are the same. What animates the research here is a desire to bring insights which are fairly commonplace in one subject field to speak to unfamiliar subject matter. And we see this happening more and more, I think, in social science now. Interdisciplinarity has itself become something of a buzzword. It's overused when you actually look at the content of the research that tries to claim the title interdisciplinary. But I think it does fit well with the use of a thinker's work to try to ground the theoretical and therefore the explanatory basis of a PhD. There's been a surge of work in international relations in the last 20 odd years, for instance, which is grounded in social theory. All those people that now use Bourdieu, for instance, in international relations, people who use Baudrillard, Foucault, Jameson, Butler, Horkheimer, etc. None of these agendas within international relations were apparent at all 20-odd years ago. They've all become much more visible only in recent times, as there has been an attempt to really turn international relations into an increasingly interdisciplinary form of knowledge production. And the use of alternative literatures, thinkers from elsewhere, has been a very, very important trend in this respect. It allows people to speak to different sorts of intellectual training with respect to distinct subject fields and to bring those insights over in creative and innovative ways into new subject fields. And you can use thinkers, I think, very productively to anchor that sort of analytical strategy. Also, there's a potentially dark side to this trait as well. You'll have all have come across the concept of economics imperialism at some point or another. So that in itself might just be a subset of the subset of interdisciplinary work. The attempt to create a unified social science based purely on the methods and insights of economics. Okay, so that's the end of my whistle-stop tour at the whys, the whos, the hows, the dos, the don'ts of applying thinkers in your research. I'm sure that my list of possible modes of application is by no means exhaustive, though, and I also look forward to you adding some of your own as the afternoon progresses. They're also by no means mutually exclusive, and I think some of these categories can be used creatively alongside one another. If it comes to a question of making thinkers talk to one another, I think that's another very useful way to use thinkers in research. Of course, there's a need to be attentive to which combinations are applied together, because some approaches, as I hope I've given you just one or two insights about already this afternoon, are not as intellectually reputable as others. There are good ways of using thinkers, and there are less good ways of using thinkers. And hopefully, one of the things that we can do over the afternoon as a whole is begin to zero in on only the good ways of using thinkers. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay, great stuff, Matt. Thanks for that. Any questions? Everybody's thinking about the thinker.
It wasn't what you were expecting, was it? You were expecting me just to talk about Adam Smith.
Okay, well, I'll jump in then. I was just wondering if there was one piece of advice that you would give to people on operationalising thinkers. Like, is there any particular things that you see PhD students that you've supervised doing that you would like to caution people against doing? Sorry, that didn't come out very well.
No, I know what you mean. I certainly always found it necessary to chirp into my PhD students' ears about the text. They think I present the text as if it held all the answers to everything. And in some ways, I think it does when you're using a thinker's work. One of the difficulties, of course, and I guess the major pitfall, is the question of whether we ever come to the text without preformed interpretive lenses. Do we only read thinkers in the first place because other scholars have told us that those thinkers are important to read? Do we only read thinkers in the first place because other scholars have not only told us that those thinkers are important to read, but have told us how to read it, told us what we will find of importance there in terms of our own work? So it's extremely difficult, and I don't think anybody should even try to simply blank their mind and believe that they can come to a text as if it was a blank canvas. So I think everyone has to be aware that they're continually negotiating this process of reading and not reading at the same time. And by that I mean you might be looking at all the words in front of you, but through whose perspective are you looking at those words? Is it the thinker's own perspective, or is it the interpretive devices that you've already been provided with that have told you to go and read that thinker in the first place? I know this is something, for instance, that Chris has to wrestle with constantly when using Skinner and Skinner's methodological rules, and the struggles that come around from being attentive to those methodological rules, which seem to apply brilliantly in the abstract, but then they get you to seriously question whether you can really genuinely read anything as an authentic representation of what was intended anymore. And it's really, really tough. So I think, now he's gone, that would be my main piece of advice, to always try to make sure that you're absolutely clear that there are these two moments to reading anything. There's the text itself, which is still of paramount importance, but there's also the reasons that you were brought to that text in the first place, which are other people's interpretive devices. And if those interpretive devices continue to form part of the way in which you read the text, then you must be aware of that. And I think it's a plea for honesty as well in the way that you use a thinker's work by revealing the strategies of reading that you impose upon that reader's that thinker's work. And those strategies of reading themselves come from the sorts of interpretive devices that you take from other sources within the literature. So it's really tough, but I would still rather see my PhD students do that than avoid the text altogether. I annoy them intensely, I think, over a series of months and years by keep saying, what about the text? What about the text? What's it saying there? Hopefully they forgive me eventually. I don't know. They might be better placed to tell you that. No.
One of the things that I might want to add to your seven different ways of reading the text is a kind of wider contextualization of the historical setting in which that text was written. Because I know, for example, Ellen Wood has criticized Skinner for narrowing the context, narrowing the setting to the text or to the kind of narrow intellectual environment in which that thinker was operating. And something like, I don't know if you read, for example, I know a few people have read Francis Wheen's biography of Marx. It's not just about who he was interacting with intellectually. It's not just about the text that he was writing. It's the wider setting.
Yeah.
It's, you know, 1848 revolutions. It's spectre haunting Europe. So something kind of the wider social setting, I think, might also be important in that sense.
It is, absolutely. And that really should go onto my list as well. I kick myself, especially because, as Cathy will know because she sits in on my MA groups, I bang on relentlessly to my MA students about the often narrow historical windows in which particular texts were written, and therefore the concepts that underpin the text themselves and the explanatory devices in the text have a distinct meaning that's linked to the historical conditions in which they were generated. And one of the important things is that to remember here is that we tend to use thinkers as much for their conceptual development as anything else. But those concepts don't always easily travel across distinct places, both in time and in space. And if those concepts don't travel, then something has to be done to tweak the explanatory framework that's developed out of those concepts. Otherwise, it simply might not work for the subject matter of subsequent generations, time and space. So there's an important lesson about contextualisation. You're absolutely right, Nick. And it's one that I should very much have mentioned. So thank you. So,
one thing that I think, one way I define kind of thinker or great thinker, if you want, kind of grandiose term.
Are those different things, then?
I think they are, but I'll come to that.
Okay.
Well, no, and hopefully you'll come to that. but one thing kind of running down the list of people we're looking at today is kind of their transdisciplinary nature. So, because, you know, in today's academic world, we're refs and all this, and we're constantly being kind of rationalised in kind of this Weberian sense into our little pigeonholes. If you look down these lists, one thing that kind of puts people like myself in awe of these people is that they kind of just transcend their talk within. I was taught, you know, Foucault and Jameson and Marx and people like that in historiography courses, and of course the political science people are taught them in political science, and they're just, you know, across a range of subjects they get taught. So do you think that's kind of fundamental to, or do you think kind of within discrete fields you can become a thinker, if that's possible?
I think you probably can, because I'm not sure anyone would want to take the status of thinker away from someone like Rawls. You could say, well, okay, political theorists and philosophers both use Rawls, but they're doing the same sort of work, really. So I hope you can, but there's an interesting comment there, isn't there, about professionalisation. And the social sciences have become increasingly professionalised, which means divided into disciplines. And it might be much more difficult then to engage in the sort of polymathic thought that does seem to shine through the lists of people that we're talking about here. That you can't constrain these people and restrict them to one subject field rather than anything else. They do instinctively talk in forms of analysis which seem to be applicable across those boundaries. But the more that professionalisation gets linked to talking to peers in a particular subject field and to gain reputation and research funding, etc., relative to being able to talk that sort of professionalised language, that maybe means that the less it becomes possible to imagine contemporary thinkers being able to arrive to being able to arrive at thinker status, let alone great thinker status. Because I think a great thinker does have to be a polymath. I'm not sure a great thinker can be restricted to a deeply professionalised single subject field. It might also tell us something about intellectual developments in different countries, because of the more modern people here, one of the things that seems to tie them, looking at the programme of events, I know there's competing things have just arrived now.
Transdisciplinary interest.
But none of these people have been forced to present themselves in relation to the needs and demands of ref panels, for instance. So if that's a form of professionalisation that requires some degree of conformity, then great thinker status is probably, or the potential for great thinker status is probably much undermined by living and working within that sort of professionalised university experience. It's a great shame, but probably nonetheless true.
I mean, you wouldn't be able to get kind of Das Kapital written in kind of today's environment, 10 years in the British Library, ref submissions.
And the argument that everyone makes about Rawls is that he would never have written a theory of justice if he was subjected to REE constraints, because Central University, in their infinite wisdom, would have moved him out of his position and probably onto a teaching only post, because he didn't publish anything for 9 years while he was writing the theory of justice. And why would you need to publish anything for the previous 9 years if at the end of 9 years you come up with that? But that's not the way that that our day-to-day life is now routinely disciplined and regularised through the oversight procedures that go from ref constraints into university house and then come back to us at departmental level. David?
I'm very happy to ask my question while people are eating, if that allows me to.
Can I suggest we just continue the Q&A over pizza and soda? Is that,
okay, but you're going to save me some, seeing as I'm going to be giving all the answers, aren't you?
You've not heard, you've not heard David's question.
Okay, that's a good point. I remember his 92-page first-year review submission, so it could take a while.
I've forgotten
them. No, still etched on my memory, Dave.
It's a selection.
Interesting.
Well, there's a couple of major pieces.
But, you know, you can't be a great thinker without being transdisciplinary. And the talk that you gave on getting an academic job, they ask you about what are the interdisciplinary consequences of your research. However, once you're in the job, then you're increasingly within the system, and they try to professionalise you, as you say.
Yeah, all the
contradictions.
All the professional incentives are to treat those questions about how would you engage interdisciplinary. As, right, I know I'm going to be asked this. I know I've got to have an answer. Here's my answer. It's a bit of a routine pat answer, and that'll do. And if you give me the code, I don't need to think about that at all ever again anymore. Interdisciplinarity is something that the research councils now have a lot of time for, and presume is very, very important. But the demonstration of interdisciplinarity in one's own work is extremely difficult.
Thanks very much.
To actually display. Could I have the ginger beer, if possible, of course?
I'll grab another one.
Yep, sorry.